Hello, and welcome to our ongoing special podcast series on the World Radio Communication Conference 2023. Now that WRC has wrapped up, we've decided to continue this series to break down some of the major decisions made at the conference. Before the start of WRC last month in Dubai, the Radio Assembly took place. This is an important event which sets out the structure and work program of the study groups at the conference. And this year, it also saw the approval of the ITU's IMT 2030 framework. For those unfamiliar with ITU jargon, IMT stands for International Mobile Telecommunications. It's basically how the ITU describes mobile broadband. Previously, the ITU was working towards defining IMT 2020, which is more commonly known as 5G, and now it's looking to the future with IMT 2030, which is more commonly known as 6G. Although 6G is still a way out, it's worth considering how the ITU is thinking about it. We're starting to get an idea of what 6G might be, and more importantly for our readers, what spectrum bands it may use. With me here to talk about this document and 6G more widely is Dean Bubley. Dean is an independent analyst and founder and director of Disruptive Analysis. Hi Dean, good to talk to you.
And you, Richard. Good morning.
First, I wanted to touch on what the ITU calls ubiquitous connectivity. So you noticed that the document mentions that 6G will improve coverage of networks and coverage in rural areas as well. But it also mentions indoor coverage, which is something you noticed and stood out to you. Why is indoor coverage important? And why is it good, in your opinion, that the ITU mentions it in this document?
Right. Thank you. Yeah, now I've followed the evolution of indoor wireless for a very long time as part of my broader research on telecoms and networks. And in fact, I've been specifically drilling into the opportunities, challenges, and sort of benefits of good indoor wireless of all sorts recently. And whether it's for cellular networks or other technologies, which most obviously is Wi-Fi, but all the IoT technologies, aspects of sensing and so on as well, specialist technologies for audio, visual, and medical and other sectors. The cellular, indoor cellular, is challenging for two reasons. First off is historically, the mobile industry, as the name suggests, was about mobility, which was people walking around or in vehicles. And it was almost a historical accident that people started using mobile phones and mobile networks in building. Today, it accounts for perhaps 70 to 80% of all cellular use is inside a home or the workplace or schools or public spaces, which has both technical challenges, because of the challenges of propagation and indoor penetration of different wireless signals, but also because of the sort of commercial and practical challenges of offering a public mobile service on private property. Unlike if you think of other things, services we get, could be utilities like electricity or water, there's a clear demarcation point where, where something comes into the building and where it's the building owner's responsibility or the service provider responsibility. Clearly for wireless signals, they can reach varying points into the building. There's no fixed demarcation point. There's no clear delineation of responsibility. And so indoor wireless or indoor cellular has always been a bit of a hotly contested question as to sort of whose responsibility is it, who pays for any additional infrastructure, or whether that's a repeater or booster or a dedicated indoor system. And now there's also another added layer of complexity from private cellular networks as well, which may also be using similar spectrum bands and technology. So all in all, indoor cellular is very important and, in my view, very overlooked by regulatory and policy domains. It's just, it's complicated and it doesn't tend to get the headlines.
Absolutely. And another challenge is for the mobile operators of spectrum as well. Generally, lower band spectrum is better for indoor coverage because it penetrates deeper into buildings, doesn't it?
Yes. So you've got this trade-off where the low-band spectrum, typically, especially below a gigahertz, maybe below 2 gigahertz in some cases, goes through at least one wall very well, sometimes two walls. It may still struggle with sort of deep basements and and sort of maybe, you know, buildings or structures which have thick concrete, or maybe a hospital where you've got some metal shielding. But the paradox here is that a lot of the capabilities we talk about, especially for 5G and future 6G, whether that's, you know, ultra high performance, ultra low latency, they tend to only be realistic in higher spectrum bands, you know, where you've got enough headroom to offer those capabilities, you know, mid band and eventually up to sort of millimeter wave and so on. And the paradox here is that the higher the performance, the worse the indoor coverage from outside. And so then you have to think about, you know, dedicated indoor systems of one form or another.
Yeah. Do you take it as a positive thing, though, that the ITU has mentioned indoor connectivity in its kind of IMT definition?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, yeah, to be honest, you could argue it should have done that with 5G and 4G previously, but it's something of a victory that it's actually got called out. I did a search of the document, and there's several mentions of the word indoor. I now start doing this with any sort of policy document about cellular. I search the PDF for indoor or in building and a couple of other synonyms, just to see if they take it seriously. I mean, it doesn't have to be the ITU. It could be a governmental or regulatory one. And it's surprising how infrequently even one of those terms even occurs in a document. So I think here it was, you know, the phrase I've seen is maintaining consistency of user experience between different locations, including deep indoor coverage, which is, certainly as a statement of intent or a goal or a recommendation, it's very useful to have that as a stake in the ground, because quite often we found, say, particularly with 5G in the past, that indoor coverage was an afterthought. It wasn't designed in as an original design goal, whereas here it is for 6G. And, you know, whether we could argue that 6G is, if you like, indoor primary, or at least co-primary, I guess, is up for the debate. But I'm just pleased to see that there's at least some official recognition of its importance.
Yeah, it's kind of an acknowledgement that there's things in 5G that could be improved. Like you said, indoor coverage is maybe not perfect yet, and that is kind of there's a few strands of what 6G might be, and one of them is let's improve on what we've got.
Totally. And I think the important thing here is everyone talks about the potential values of 5G, and have been, you know, there's been forecasts of this number of hundreds of billions of economic benefit or social benefit, and no one actually looked at the applications and go, hang on, most of those are indoors. You know, education is indoors, healthcare almost entirely indoors, most industrial automation indoors, gaming, mostly indoors. AR/VR, mostly indoors. So all of the things that we've been holding up as, you know, with the exception maybe of vehicles, as a major 5G use case, has been indoor applications. And so, you know, if you basically take the value, the view that, you know, 70-80% of the traffic for 5G will be indoors and applications, that roughly equates to 70-80% of the value. And yet, probably fewer than 5% of sort of regulatory and policy discussions have even mentioned the word.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. So in terms of spectrum, the document does mention that IMT 2030/6G will use a wide variety of bands, including low, mid, and high. I think previously there was an assumption that with each new generation, you would naturally go higher in the bands. We saw millimeter wave and 5G, and now there's this idea of terahertz spectrum. What do you think the prospects are for terahertz in 6G?
I'm a terahertz skeptic. I mean, to be honest, I was a millimeter wave skeptic as well, and that hasn't really gone very far. No pun intended, it doesn't go very far is the problem. And it goes through walls or windows even worse. And I think that whether it's millimeter wave or the officially called sub-terahertz, you have that propagation challenge. You've got massive amounts of capacity in a very, very localized space. So it might work for something inside a room, maybe inside a vehicle, possibly even inside a solid object. So you could imagine it inside a computer or phone motherboard connecting between components. But there is going to be a huge challenge of going any greater distances where there's obstacles in the way. And that's particularly important for if you consider that the construction of buildings these days is getting more and more radio hostile. So the thing called low E glass, which is great for stopping heat leaking in or out of a building, and is a major part of making buildings more climate friendly, but they also turn them into Faraday cages. That is incompatible with the requirement for outdoor to indoor propagation. And ironically, some of the higher frequencies, even the ones we've been talking about, the sort of upper mid band, the 6 to 10 gigahertz range, you can get through walls or windows with MIMO, but that needs lots of energy, which again is not really, you don't want to be blasting through walls, is a phrase I'd heard, if you're either from the network or from the device at the other end, from a sustainability point of view either. So, terahertz, I think in the document from ITU, to me, it was almost absent. It looks like it's a lot of interest to people in academia. Obviously, there's probably some patent holders or people who are doing current research on it. But in the real world, I'm not sure what we'd use it for. Most of the things that I can think about using for aren't really IMT. Connecting stuff inside a car or inside a computer, that's not mobile telephony. It's wireless and it's interesting. And I can understand why, if you're studying that, you would love to have it officially as part of the 6G standards, because you'd massively increase the awareness, the reach, the value of that invention. But it's not mobile. There's possibility of using some of those very high bands for the combined sensing and communication ideas in 6G. But even that, I'm not sure that's always going to be the best way. I mean, I was just listening to something else about the combined sensing communication. And the idea is you might use the same spectrum, you might use the same electronics in the base station to combine the connectivity aspect with sensing the local environment. But on the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, you could also do quite a lot of that with a cheap camera and some machine learning and a machine vision technology. You don't really need to use terahertz waves to tell you there's a car when you can probably do that on a $10 camera.
Yeah, I mean, sensing even works in lower frequencies. I know there's been some testing of doing sensing with Wi-Fi as well.
Oh, it's more than testing. It's in the standards. I think it's 802.11bf, I think, is the one. And they use it for things like motion sensing in the home. Mm-hmm. So you can use Wi-Fi as essentially a motion detector. And if you've got a mesh, it's accurate enough to sort of do things like distinguish between a human and a cat moving. So from a security point of view, you don't want to have false alarms. And ultimately, every time you go into a door with an automatic opener, it's using sensing, wireless sensing.
Yeah, a very basic form of it.
Yeah, reverse detectors or parking detectors on a car. Again, it's sensing.
I think the document from the ITU does play down maybe terahertz a little bit. I think they mentioned there's significant challenges. There's a separate document they're working on, a separate working group that's going to look into this more specifically. Do you think that's a sign that there's been some learnings from 5G and from millimeter wave, that there's less focus, less kind of hype around terahertz?
I think there's quite a lot of people who got stunned by millimeter wave. To my view, it was largely predictable, but I can understand why people had to try it anyway. There's been no secret of this idea that high frequencies don't go very far and they don't go through walls. This is not news to anyone. So I was always a bit confused as sort of what the market for really high density, and everyone talked about football stadiums with line of sight, or you're standing underneath a lamppost with a small cell in the middle of a city. Fair enough. As soon as you're walking in the city and you go into a building, it's no use. You're reliant on whatever they've got inside. Or you flip back down to mid-band or lower, which is possible, but then you lose all the performance that you were getting with the millimeter wave. So I'm unsurprised that it's been downplayed. I think that there was a lot of enthusiasm in some quarters about a year or two ago, but I think that there's been a bit of a reality check. And it does come back to this idea of, what is 6G about? And I see a few different trajectories. I'd say initially I thought there were two pathways, and I'd say there's a third. The first two that I thought were the sort of maximum theoretical performance, which essentially is more the sort of R&D academia focused view of how do we crank everything up to 11. the performance, the frequency band, microsecond latencies. We want to have it work in space. We want to have it work underwater. We want to have it usable for the use cases like what was the one I've heard of, sort of teleportation and multi-sensory this. And there was a long list of things. And I rather cruelly described it as it's great if you're doing metaverse for dolphins. But in the real world, a lot of that stuff is science projects. Now, they're worthwhile science projects, and they're important. They're maybe niche applications.
That's the kind of road that terahertz would be important in, I think, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, it probably wouldn't work underwater, that particular one. But yeah, but that type of vision of 6G is being, dial everything up to 11. The alternative philosophy, which I'm seeing more interest in, is what I call maximum usefulness, which is also looking at 5G and thinking, well, what doesn't it do? Whether it's we'd like to have a version that uses less power and energy consumption and lower carbon footprint from more recyclable elements to it. Maybe it's more indoor friendly. Maybe it's more rural area friendly, whether that's terrestrial or from satellite or HAPS or something like that. More sharing friendly. And also, importantly, designed upfront to work either for traditional MNOs or for private networks or for enterprises or governments or infrastructure sharing organizations. And it's almost like business model neutral. So that was the other philosophy that I have in my mind, the sort of max usefulness rather than max performance. And there's a third one, which I've seen more recently, which is coming from parts of the traditional telecoms and mobile industry, which I would almost like to say is, a moderate upgrade of 5G. It's not reinventing anything very much, and it's not hurried. It's essentially 5G on steroids with the same ecosystem and the same operator and business model concepts. So that's the sort of the limited change evolution, not revolution philosophy, I would say.
Yeah, and I think all of those three scenarios are encompassed in this ITU document. It's kind of a kitchen sink approach, this document. And maybe it's because it's, only the first stage of the ITU's process of developing 6G. But it has everything in it. It's got everything from sensing, holographic, and automated driving to also marginal improvements to coverage, improvements to latency, and things like that. So I think at this point, we still haven't picked a road.
No. And there's a few things about it. I noticed that there's an interesting definition of the word ubiquitous, which is essentially is ubiquity applies to your target areas, which to me is a bit circular and self-contradictory and sort of implies that, well, it's ubiquitous within the area you want it to be ubiquitous in, but isn't elsewhere. Which to me, you can sense that there's obviously been written by a large number of people trying to find commonality, and there's probably been an awful lot of midnight wordsmithing going on behind the scenes. Yeah.
I think if you promised ubiquity everywhere, it'd be difficult because you're going to have to put 5G and 6G on the Alps, and you're going to have to do things that are incredibly challenging for not much benefit.
Yeah, but it specifically talks about it's not ubiquitous across a country. It's a bit more, you could say it could be, that's great if you just want to have a network in an area and you have 6G in the city and 5G in the rural area, maybe. But to me, it looked like a little bit of a get out of saying, we'll allow you to define ubiquity the way you want. And I think there's a couple of bits and pieces like that that I also saw another thing that the RA event did, which essentially was redefine IMT to include fixed wireless access. I think because they realized that the killer app for 5G turned out to be fixed wireless access, and it was technically not mentioned up front.
Oh, yeah, I noticed that as well. I think that's seen as the maybe success story of 5G, hasn't it? So they're keen to introduce that into the definition.
Yeah, no, I mean, it always amused me that fixed access was never in the original 5G triangle. I don't think it's in the new 6G hexagon either, which is amusing because it's almost certainly going to be a use case.
So in terms of these three approaches that might happen with 6G, which do you think is most likely to happen? What's the industry most interested in actually developing?
Well, I suppose how you define the industry. And also, there's another dimension on this, which is there going to be one version of 6G, or is there going to be a geopolitical split, whether it's China versus the West or something else, or multiple versions? So I think that, I don't think it's going to be purist in one sense or another. And I think that there will clearly be some sort of cool advanced features, whether they're in the first, what is it, release 21, or whether they come in late, 6G plus or something in the mid 2030s. I think there's plenty of scope for, the original version of 6G to be more constrained in terms of capabilities, and then later releases having some of the more advanced capabilities or theoretical capabilities if the studies prove that they actually work effectively. And I think, what will probably come out of this is more of a schedule and a timeline for what to expect when. To me, the more of the question is whether there is an early release 6G, the same way there was with 5G with non-standalone, or whether it's more of a one-shot, agree everything up front, no more complicated multiple migration paths. And that I'm not sure, because a lot of it may not even depend on radio or spectrum. It might be driven more by considerations of the core network. And I think that one of the things that's happened with 5G is people underestimated how much heavy lifting there was in doing the whole sort of cloud native core, and that part of the overall infrastructure has turned out to be a lot more complicated and time consuming than many expected. Whereas, ironically, apart from the millimeter wave, the radio bit is actually been, well, if not straightforward, then it's a known path.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to watch how this all develops. And the ITU is still in a very early stage, and they will have their own vision of what it is. And then the standards will start developing it, and we'll see it all happen, in the next few years, and get a better picture of what's exactly going to go on with 6G, what it's going to be.
I think so. And I think one of the interesting challenges here is that I don't know if ITU, particularly ITUR, is necessarily as close to some of the software elements as other bits of the industry, the 3GPP and other standards bodies. And increasingly, whether it's the sensing, whether it's the sort of AI native capabilities, the core, as I mentioned, a lot of that is going to be driven by software considerations and cloud and edge considerations. There's one thing that I was quite pleased to see that was also toned down. I've seen some early versions of 6G recommendation, which or expectations were saying, 6G is going to redefine the future of distributed computing. The future sort of edge compute and edge to core architecture will come out of IMT 2030. And I'm like deeply skeptical of that. I think that the mobile industry generally is a customer of cloud and edge rather than the provider of cloud and edge. There's an awful lot of cloud and edge which has nothing to do with cellular at all. Most of the fixed enterprise world runs on fiber. So by the time we get to 2030, I think there's going to be an awful lot of interesting stuff going on with cloud architectures, and I'm not convinced that the mobile industry is going to be the initiator of most of that.
We haven't really seen that develop in 5G either, extensive edge computing from the operators.
No. I mean, there was lots of talk about MEC, but it turns out, in the end, most of the use of cloud platforms has been commercial hyperscale cloud. And there might have been local instances, and we've certainly seen things like wavelength from AWS that goes in the mobile network. But if you look at Amazon's overall edge portfolio, Wavelength is one of about 20 edge type products and solutions that it has, ranging from real-time operating systems for IoT up to them sending you a truck full, literal truck full of servers to offload your data if you happen to have a petabyte data center that you want to have backed up.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Dean, for talking us through some of those issues. We will be keen to watch what happens, and I'm sure you'll share your thoughts over time as well. Do you want to plug any of your upcoming events or potential upcoming events? I don't know if you've settled on those.
Yeah, sure. So coming back to the topic of indoor wireless, I mean, I guess as it happens in London yesterday, as we're recording this, I ran the first workshop, first of all, called the Indoor Wireless Stakeholders Group. And that's like looking at indoor cellular, Wi-Fi, private networks, some of it's spectrum-related, some of it's looking at things like neutral host models, and also the use cases and different verticals. And I'm going to be doing more of those during 2024. There's one in Florida on April 22nd, and there's probably going to be one in Geneva later in the year, maybe other countries around Europe and the world. And the point being there is to get lots of people from a technology point of view, service provider, ideally property, investor, and regulatory and policy together to talk about how do we fix indoors, you know, or even just recognize that it's as important as it is. So, you know, please do follow me on, you know, particularly on LinkedIn, because I write about this sort of stuff fairly regularly.
Great. Cool. Yeah, I think LinkedIn's the best place to keep up with you, isn't it, Dean?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely use it more than Twitter or X these days.
All right. Thanks, Dean.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you've enjoyed it, I encourage you to subscribe. The Policy Tracker Spectrum podcast is available on all major podcasting platforms. And if you'd like to read more about WRC, we will soon be publishing an updated dossier on the Policy Tracker Research Service. This in-depth dossier goes through all of the most important agenda items in detail and explains what the implications are for the next conference in 2027. Thanks for listening and see you next time.